From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Is American English sexist? How does the language we speak reflect, embrace, and modify at social and individual levels the connections between gender and speech? Soundings now presents the second in a series of discussions about language. My guest is Charis Cremeray, a professor of speech communication at the University of Illinois. Charis Cremeray is the author of several books about language and gender, including The Voices and Words of Women and Men and Language, Gender, and Society. Charis, tell me, what is a sociolinguist? Big 50-cent word there.
It's someone who's interested in taking a look at language as it relates to the way that it's used by people in various social groups. For example, black, white, English differences. I'm particularly interested in both black, white, English, and in female, male.
Okay, now you have identified yourself as a linguist and a feminist, linguist slash feminist. Give me a for instance, something that to your ears is either offensive or something that would jump out at you as an example of your sensitivity to language and women's issues.
Okay, there are many of us in this country who are taking a look at many characteristics of female-male speech. And one of the things that a number of us are looking at are, for example, interruptions. Even when people don't hear the interruptions after a gathering, if you run a tape through, people are finding many more interruptions on the part of males.
Now you make me hesitant to interrupt.
Yes. Did I do this deliberately? In a great many settings. Mm-hmm. Classroom settings, doctor-patient interaction. Candace West has done a lot of work, and Don Zimmerman on the West Coast have done a lot of work with patient-doctor interaction and sex differences and interruptions in the classroom, in social gatherings.
Is this the sort of thing that goes on because of class? Does it go on because people are simply people? You can have a high class talking to a low class, a high brow and a low brow. How do you figure these things out?
Yes, and a lot of things going on. There are a lot of status differences, and it's not to say that all interruptions are bad interruptions. One of the things that does seem to be characteristic. Most of the stereotypes of women's speech do not hold up. But one of the things that does seem to be characteristic of something that perhaps shouldn't be called women's speech, but is something that many women engage in and welcome, is collaborative talk, in which you do have a give and take. You have unfinished sentences. You have building upon the other person's talk. So it's not that all interruptions are bad. It depends upon the function of those interruptions, when it's really to cut off someone who wanted to continue going, mm-hmm. or whether it's really building upon something that someone is saying and pauses and welcomes.
Tell me what you mean, Charis, by a phrase such as the proprietors of language. Who are they and how did they take control?
How did they take control is difficult because that's a complex historical question. But the proprietors of language, what I have talked about is what happens when the histories of the English language are written. If you look at the histories of the English language, it's very difficult to find any involvement of women. Mm-hmm. You won't see, it is as if women use language, but they have nothing to do with the creation of language. There's no linguistic creativity, supposedly. So it appears that all the coinages and all the definitions have been made by men.
And that's not right.
Well, Paula Treichler and I are working on a feminist dictionary, uh-huh. which is taking a look at a lot of the linguistic creativity that women have shown through the years that has not been represented in the standard dictionaries.
Now, when you say creativity, Charis, are you talking about etymology? Is it as crude as something like the following? A woman has invented a word and has not been given credit for it, or a word is used in such a fashion that it's peculiar to women, it's the domain of women? Tell me about that.
Both. There are a lot of word coinages because women don't have the same access to printed sources and to newspapers, to Wall Street, to a lot of the publicity. Men's coinages get much more currency. It's partly that the words that women have made up, and there have been many of them, and we're trying to gather those together, have not been represented in the dictionaries. It's also that women's perception, because women's experiences in our culture are quite different from men's, their definitions are quite different. How they would define home, how they would define marriage, is different. So it's both those things. It's the coinages and the definitions.
Well, let's pause on those two terms, home or marriage. Give me some concrete threads here to follow. Are you talking about, for instance, how would a man define that as set against the way a woman might define it? Or for the purposes of your feminist dictionary?
Well, if you look in traditional dictionaries, they have under marriage the state of being husband and wife, or in some cases, man and wife.
Uh-huh.
But through the years, women have defined marriage in a quite different way. And this has not been picked up, although I found it going back to the 17th century, certainly in the 19th century, in the 20th century, many women have defined marriage as a trade, as something that girls are brought up to with a view of getting a job in it, trade.
Parenthetically, when you say it hasn't been picked up, does that mean it hasn't found its way into the conventional dictionaries?
Yes.
I see.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And this idea of marriage as a trade, as a commercial or trade undertaking, goes through the years. I have found a dozen illustrations of it, and that we don't see represented. That's not to say that all women would look upon it in this way, but what the women stress is the economic, and not, for example, sentiment, that this is economically important for women. It's one way of getting support, and so they stress the trade. It's almost compulsory. One woman said it's a trade. It's almost a compulsory trade for women. If indeed a good many people think of marriage as a trade, if one were really trying to make a dictionary that represented popular ideas about it, that would be there. Because it's not a part of the dictionary, we think, well, that's sort of an attitude toward it, and it's not the real definition.
It hasn't really been validated
in
a scholarly
scholarly
sense. Sharice, we're talking about language and gender. Give me some examples of labels, stereotypes that are used about men and women.
Well, that's a whole big area of study because women have been well labeled. They haven't labeled themselves, except as we're indicating in the feminist dictionary, they have, but that hasn't been picked up and used in periodicals and in mass media. But there's a great deal of men's labeling of women. For example, Julie Penelope, a linguist, has taken a look at the terms that are used for a promiscuous woman and a promiscuous man. Well, she stopped when she got 220 words for a promiscuous woman.
For women.
And found, I think, 22 for men. Now, why is this? Why do we feel the need to have so many terms? And they are not terms that have been applied by women to women. You can take a look at what happens to any word that is associated with a female. Muriel Schultz, in an article called The Semantic Derogation of Women, has taken a look at what happens to any word that's used for woman. And what happens is that word, from going from a neutral word defining a female person, slides down so that it means sexually promiscuous. And actually, the word woman, which was in use some time ago, did that slide, fell into disuse because of that, and now we can use it as a fairly neutral word, but there's evidence that it's going through the slide again. Any word that's applied to the female. We know that, for example, words like spinster meant woman who spins, and in the feminist dictionary, Paula Treichler and I are taking a look at the etymology of that word because it went from that, it became then a task that, spinning became a task that was evidently given to the oldest or the perhaps most unattractive member of the family.
Why was that? Pause on that for a moment. Have you nailed that down? Have you figured out, is there a first usage or...
Well, that anything that is connected to, there are very interesting things that happened. Any word that's connected to a task or to that is held by primarily women or women themselves.
And here we get back to your earlier comments about trade and what one does, how one spends one's time. Is that it?
Yes, and because women...
I mean, you're bringing in a sort of an economic dimension here.
Yes.
Particularly with regard to this word spinster.
Yes. Uh-huh. No, I think that's right, that the things that women do, no matter what it is, and we know that what women and men do varies somewhat from culture to culture, but in any culture that we have evidence of, what the men do is more highly valued, even if it's something that in another culture it's what women do. And so the terms that come to be associated with that occupation also do sort of a slide and are not as valued. Yeah. And so spinster's one word. Terms that supposedly are matches, such as governor and governess, now that what those two terms mean to us today, they're not certainly comparable terms. Other words that have different meanings, even if we take the meanings now, a spinster as an unmarried woman, there are very different connotations between spinster and bachelor. It's a perhaps a fine term to be associated with if you're a young man.
What about bachelorette? What's wrong with that? What's good or bad about it?
There are a number of terms that label women by putting sort of the diminutives on them, uh-huh. So the IE endings. It was one of the ways that people tried to demean what the people who were campaigning for women's suffrage did. And so they were labeled by a paper in London as the suffragettes. Uh-huh. And what they did was take that term, label a newspaper with it, and try to make it a very positive term. But it's a problem.
I happen to be married to a woman whose name is Paulette.
Yes.
Would you tell her that she should hang her head about her name?
What we know about, of course, is that many of the words, the names that are given to women are diminutives of men's names.
But this has nothing to do with some sort of bad intention.
Bad intention.
It's not a put down.
Well, in that, can you think of men's names that come from women's names and have a little ending on them, such as Paula?
I can think of in the South, for instance, there are grown men. We had a president whose name was Jimmy. Now, there are a lot of people in the country who said Jimmy, and they never really did get comfortable with
Get comfortable with that. That's uh-huh. right, because that's okay for little boys, but not mm-hmm. for grown men, because it's diminutive.
I see.
And women have a lot of those applied to them. The IE ending for words associated with women is very familiar. And he was trying to do something also with that by not trying to get rid of that and saying that he was a very friendly, open person. And there are a lot of men who don't want to try to do that.
Mm-hmm. Sharis, we're talking about language and gender. You make me think about nicknames for some reason or other. Is there sexism involved there? For instance, when kids, male or female, go around with names like Nikki or Bobby or Billy or Susie or something like that?
Well, in that men usually get rid of those as they grow up, and women retain them.
Uh-huh.
Well, it's not so much they hang on to them as they're continue to be labeled that way. The assumption is that that's okay, and you have to check with a man before you call him Jimmy. He has to give an okay, but the women continue to get those.
Mm-hmm.
There are other labels, of course, for women. There are a lot of food labels for women.
There are, like what?
Well, like cheesecake and peaches strawberries
right.
and honey. There are a lot of animal names for women. You know, the bunny, the kitty, the cat.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of meat names. There are a lot of unpleasant names plates.
And none for men or fewer?
Can you think of them? I have trouble thinking of them, finding them.
Beefcake, I suppose. That's the only
They're very
one.
Few. They're yeah. very few. And they really usually have a positive connotation.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that a man is proud of. And there are very few of those words that that women can be proud of.
Yeah. You're describing language as politics, aren't
yes.
you?
Yes. Yes, that's right.
Tell me about your feminist dictionary in that regard. What are you after? What's the aim of it?
Well, Several things. Women are thought not to be able to handle linguistic creativity, and we find many, many examples that mm-hmm. women certainly are. We're trying to bring together in one place a lot of the definitions, a lot of the word coinages that women have used and that have not received wide publicity, so it's difficult for us to use those, and we're trying to bring that together in one place. We don't think of it as any way comprehensive. In fact, we're going to include in the back of this book some blank pages for people to put down their favorite definitions mm-hmm. and collect, and we hope to have a second, third, fourth edition.
Sharis, tell me how the Feminist Dictionary project that you're working on, how's that being received in the academy, in the American universities?
Well, of course, it's not out yet, and so we don't have those, but the university which is supporting it, Paula Treichler and I both work at the University of Illinois, mm-hmm. and we're receiving support there for it, and certainly we're receiving a great deal of interest. There was a notice of the dictionary in Ms. Magazine and other mm-hmm. Sources, and we received a great many letters, postcards with words. This is how we say it in the East, and a great many contributions. And so there's a great deal of attention from a great many sources.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the second in a series of discussions about American English. My guest is Sharis Cremeray, a professor of speech communication at the University of Illinois. Sharis Cremeray is co-editor of a forthcoming Feminist Dictionary of American English. Among her books are Feminist Scholarship in Theory and Practice and Language, Gender, and Society.
I think there's some people who, when they hear the general subject matter, language and gender, think, aha, that's on the topic of the so-called generics, the use of man and he. And indeed, it does embrace that. That is one of the problem areas. And we can say just a bit about that as a problem. It wasn't enough for many women to say, this is a problem. It doesn't include when those so-called generics are used. I don't feel included. But because that wasn't enough, and that people didn't pick up on that, there are now many studies that have been done indicating that indeed, when those words are used, people do not imagine, do not include women. When you use the word he or use the word man, supposedly as a universal term, mm-hmm. people don't see, they don't see in their mind those words. So that's one.
What preference would you express? Would you say he or she, he and she?
Oh, there are many alternatives. Certainly that's one, she or he. Uh-huh. There's also, of course, the plural that one can use. Will everyone pick up his book, their book?
Let me ask you to get technical for a moment, Sharis. In the Romance languages, I know some Spanish, it's possible to designate a him or a her with a sort of neutral, non-gender, I guess you'd call it, pronoun or reference. Why don't we have those things in English? What happened to our language? Surely you can't say that it was somebody's deliberate decision, or was it?
Well, each of the language, each of the Western culture language has problems with sexism in language, and they, as you've indicated, they differ mm-hmm. in the different languages, and the remedies differ in the different languages, and so the impact of these various gendered words differs for the languages, and feminists in the various countries have proposed quite different solutions. Whether you want to try to use so-called neutral words, or whether you actually want to use the words that stress whether it is a male or a female involved mm-hmm. in an occupation, for example, for occupational terms. So it's quite interesting in that there's a great deal of interaction among feminists concerned about language topics in various countries, but their problems differ somewhat in the solutions.
Well, my question's about the origins of our, for instance, our preference, I'm not sure exactly that that's the right word, our inclination as a society to use the word he
yes.
rather than she or he and she. Have the feminist linguists, people who do what you do, have you looked at the origins and said, here's how we can account for what we've yes. inherited How do you do that?
Yes, there are a number of linguists who have indeed taken a look at that, including taking a look at how the use of he has been legislated. The British Parliament passed a law indicating that he was to be used to represent both. He, right. And we know that it's something that kids have a great deal of trouble with, and they're taught in composition classes throughout their early years. They're corrected constantly. You cannot say, everybody pick up their books.
That's awkward.
No, it's that there's supposed to be agreement.
That's what I mean.
But it's agreement number, and not agreement with sex.
Yeah.
And why? Why the one? Why have the one been chosen over the other? Mm-hmm. We could say now it's in time to get some agreement with sex, so that if that group involves both males and females, it should include that with the pronouns.
Sharis, tell me really a sort of an impossible question. How are you going to fix the language? I mean, on the one hand, my sense is that it would take years and years, generations, to sort of train or condition humankind to talk in a non-sexist, gender-free kind of fashion. On the other hand, I can think of specific examples, like a little teeny word like Ms., that's had a really important effect on American English. People like it or they dislike it. They react to it. They know it. What would you do to fix the language?
I would say that the solutions have been proposed. How long it will take depends directly upon how much people wish to fix it. The proposals are there. We know a lot of the problems, and there are now handbooks. For example, two women have written a book called The Handbook of Non-Sexist Language. It indicates what solutions are there. Now, I think why Ms., that's had a rather rapid adoption by people, rather, is because there was felt a need for that by business. It's an easy way then of their dealing with how to indicate an address, and then they can term all women use the word miss. And so the businesses needed that, and I think that explains that. And as soon as people think that there really is a social problem here, they can make those changes overnight or close to that if they want to.
Sharis, you say that the answers are there, the solutions are there. But in saying that, you kind of shift the burden away from linguistics and into human nature. How are they connected? How are you going to get people, in other words, to assume this responsibility that they need to do something about the language, not just have the answers given to them by the linguists?
Well, as I say, if they see these as problems, and that's, of course, the difficulty, and it doesn't involve just people in sociology and in linguistics and speech communication who are a lot of the people doing this work, but everyone, because as long as these problems exist, we have established and maintained two very different social groups, women and men. Mm-hmm. And it's not women who are constantly pointing out their existence as a social group. So someone wants to maintain these two distinct groups. And as long as they see that as desirable, then these changes will be difficult.
Sharis, tell me, how sexist is American English? How much evidence is there for the kinds of changes that you want to make?
Well, how sexist is it? I think what's important is that we see it as not involving just the so-called generics such as he and man, which do create a lot of problems, but taking a look at all the ways that language is a problem. Mm-hmm. For social groups, for example, blacks, for women. And I think then you start taking a look at a lot of different topics, such as not only the words that are available in the structure of the English language, but also the use of these words. And so then this takes you into discussion about interaction, about who has the right to say what in what setting. Mm-hmm. It talks about what happens in classroom interaction and some of the problems with classroom interactions, problems for anyone who is not a white male middle class person.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. It sounds, Sharice, as though you are describing an enterprise that is more than linguistic. Linguistics may be at the core, but you're talking about sociology. You're talking about a psychological dimension here.
Yes.
This really is more than just a purely academic exercise, right?
Well, I think that's right. It crosses a lot of academic disciplines, but there are a lot of other people other than academics who are interested in that. For example, women and religion have done a great deal of work with this. It's not all new. They were doing it in the 19th century. I have found material that certainly wasn't in my history books about women's concern with language the 19th century. Women in media are very interested, in this topic. So it's not just academic, certainly. It's a social problem, and so it involves a lot of people who are interested in language as a social problem.
Mm-hmm. Where do you get your evidence? You said that people send you postcards and letters.
Oh, that's for the Feminist Dictionary. Yes, those kinds of contributions. And we're also doing a lot of work in archives for the dictionary. But if one is studying classroom interaction, one does it by going to the classrooms.
Or you go to the novels of the 19th century in America.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. So the world is out there with materials. It's certainly not because we don't have the materials to work with.
Sharice, let's conclude. Let me really put you on the spot. How would you characterize the conversation that we've had today? I imagine that as a sociolinguist, you sort of stand back and listen to the conversations that you have. Is it important that people think about language and gender in that really sort of immediate sense? There are two questions.
Well, I think that one of the things that's quite unusual and different about this is that I'm being asked to talk to you about these issues. And so in effect, although you've been asking the questions, I have also been trying to control some of the topics. And that doesn't happen in a lot of situations. And so this is sort of an unusual situation, one that of course I enjoy. Mm-hmm. the second part of your question, like most women, while talking with a man or in a mixed sex group, becomes conscious, remains conscious of what they can say, how they're being evaluated. And so I think that's a constant process, even I think for most women in many situations.
That's not linguistics, that's human nature.
Well, it's because of the present status of women in our culture. I think women have to be sensitive to this. They cannot, Bella Abzug says that she's known as a flamboyant woman. She said, I would title it as I'm outspoken, as are many other men and women. Mm-hmm. So we're conscious of the evaluation we get. When we do the same kinds of things that men might do, it's sometimes labeled in quite different way. And so we have to be careful how we talk.
Final quick question. What would you have people know about language and gender?
That it is a social problem for many people. That if one is not white, middle class, male, that there are many problems. And I think that as we become more sensitive, some of these problems will perhaps change. We're working on it.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the second in a series of discussions about American English. My guest was Sharice Cremere, professor of speech communication at the University of Illinois. Sharice Cremere is co-editor of a forthcoming Feminist Dictionary of American English. Next week, in part 3 of Soundings on American Talk, a discussion about slang. My guests will be Connie Ebley, a linguist at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Alan Metcalf, Executive Secretary of the American Dialect Society. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for part 2 in a series of discussions about American English. Is our language sexist? How does the language we speak reflect, embrace, and modify our social and individual notions about the connections between gender and language? My guest is Charis Cremeray, a professor of speech communication at the University of Illinois. Charis Cremeray is co-editor of a forthcoming feminist dictionary of American English. American Talk, Part 2, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.